Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. It's Thursday, October 19th, 2017, and we are here to talk about Week 7. That's correct, Week 7 of the NFL season. We're going to preview four games from the upcoming weekend for you, and that's going to I'm going to be accompanied on that journey by Vincent Verhey of Football Outsiders. Vince, how are you?
Mr. Barnwell, how are things today?
I'm great. I showed up several minutes late for my own podcast. Very promising start to the show. Tom Coughlin would not appreciate that. Fortunately, you are not Tom Coughlin. That would be a much worse show.
No, and I don't think we have anything in common, the two of us, but here we are. So,
might as well do it.
Let's get rolling.
Let's start with, I think, the biggest game of the weekend, pretty much. I believe most people would say Falcons-Patriots, of course, the replay of last year's Super Bowl, which was a pretty boring game. Nothing exciting happened there.
I've totally forgotten it.
Yeah, let me start with this, and I feel like it's this isn't a quantitative thing, and this is just more from your opinion. Is it possible to really think about this game or discuss this game or analyze this game without the context or the spectra of last year's Super Bowl kind of hanging over everything?
When I first sat down and started glancing over some numbers, to be totally honest, I mean, I was aware, obviously, there was a rematch of the Super Bowl, but what has happened specifically to New England since then, I mean, the 2017 Patriots have about nothing in common with the 2016 Patriots. So I, especially on defense. And so my goal when I sat down was to try and find, is there any place the Patriots defense has an advantage over the Atlanta offense?
Really?
And,
is there?
And no. they're screwed in many ways. But as I was going down and looking at stuff, it occurred to me that the Atlanta defense was equally screwed.
Yeah.
So bet the over. And then I saw these trends, and this is only 2017 data, completely ignoring anything that's happened in the past. The Atlanta defense, 18th in the first half, 27th in the second half, and the Atlanta offense, first in the first half, 26th in the second half.
Oh, no.
And I'm sitting alone in my apartment just going, oh, no. And I don't have a dog in this fight. I don't have a rooting interest for either team. But if it happens again, if the Patriots rally from a big second-half deficit and win again, it's going to be a sad, sad, sad day in Georgia.
It really would be. I don't, even if the Patriots win, I don't care either. I don't, it makes no difference to me who wins this game. It would be sad to see that be the way it is. At least let the Patriots blow the Falcons out for a while and then have the Falcons narrowly come back and just come up short. I think that'd be a much more satisfying game than the Falcons doing the opposite and blowing yet another lead. I mean, what you mentioned that the Patriots and Falcons, they've both declined dramatically on defense, but is that the only thing that's really changed about these teams? I mean, is it, what else sort of stands out to you as differences between the teams we're going to see on Sunday and the teams who lined up in the Super Bowl?
The biggest change for Atlanta has been on offense. Charles McDonald, who's one of our new writers of Football Outsiders, is Atlanta-based and covers them a lot, and he's talked about how much the offense has changed without Kyle Shanahan and with Steve Sarkisian. It's a much more conservative attack. It's much more risk-averse. Doesn't seem to realize, you know, how talented the weapons he has are. Julio Jones's role in the offense, by design, apparently, has been toned way down. There's not nearly as much effort to isolate the running backs in pass coverage when the running backs, of course, are really great receivers. You look at the matchups against New England. New England's linebackers can't cover anyone. Their defense in DVOA is next to last against number one receivers. So theoretically, Julio Jones should feast.
Right.
The Patriots are giving up like 95 yards per game to number one receivers. There's so many wet things on paper where the Falcons should just tear New England apart when they have the ball. Will they be able to unleash their own offense, basically, to drop the gloves and go at it? That's really the only question. Matchup for matchup, it's when Atlanta has the ball, they're better at virtually every position.
What about the flip side, though? What about the Patriots' offense against the Atlanta defense?
I don't know. Too much has changed there, really. The biggest difference, I guess, would be that New England has a last year their running game was pretty much like Garrett Blunt, and then they had you know, James White as a receiver out of the backfield. But now between they still have James White, they still have Mike Gillislee, who was so good in Buffalo last year. Mm-hmm. Rex Burkhead is still around. They have three or four starting caliber running backs now. So they don't have to be just Tom Brady spreading the field and looking for Rob Gronkowski in space, or, of course, Gronkowski's out of the Super Bowl, and Julian right. Edelman's out this year. So there's a big difference. But I think they're switched to they're more diverse in the sense that they're a more dangerous running team than they were last year.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I do think that there's certainly the talent there with the running game, but it does feel like they're sort of still figuring out how the running game is actually going to shake out. I mean, last week it was Gillislee until he fumbled, at which point he was persona non grata to Bill Belichick for most of the remainder of the game, and it became a much bigger role for Deion Lewis, who was barely playing early in the season. Rex Burkhead has been out with a rib injury. He did practice on a limited basis on Wednesday, the latest injury report as we record this. So, I mean, he could play on Sunday, but it is an interesting sort of situation. And the Falcons don't. Their run defense is bad. I mean, they have a 100% success rate, I want to say, in short yardage against opposing offenses so far this year, which is bad. You don't want to be allowing teams to convert in short yardage literally 100% of the time. Yeah, power situations, they are 100% of the time allowing first downs and conversions, so that's a problem. On the flip side of the game for the Falcons, you think about that defense, the one guy who you would have hoped would have turned things around for Atlanta was Desmond Trufant, who is, by all accounts, from what I've seen, from what other people say, a world-class cornerback. And I have to admit, so far this year, he has not been playing at a super high level. He's been struggling a bit. So it does seem like, you know, even though the Falcons, given that they're so young at defense, have so many, you know, guys still on rookie deals who should be getting better, it does seem like that hasn't really taken. And they've been pretty much just as bad on defense during the regular season this year as they were a year ago.
No, we just saw them blow the big lead to Miami this week. They've struggled in the second half all year. We've got them 14th against number one receivers, so right in the middle of the pack. Nothing special for sure. Mm-hmm. The only question with that against New England is who is the number one receiver these days? I guess it's Chris Hogan.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a matchup that should be in Atlanta's favor, maybe. But New England, you know, they're so good at, first of all, they have so many matchups where they do have the advantage. Mm-hmm. Second of all, they are so good at isolating their strengths and maximizing your weaknesses.
Yeah, for sure.
So even if he was having a great year, it almost wouldn't matter because they would just go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't even know what else to add to that. Atlanta's a better defense than New England, mm-hmm. But that's not saying much, and there's still plenty of weaknesses to exploit.
Yeah. I do think the Patriots can have some success there. Although I will say last year when I was writing about the Super Bowl, I looked at the numbers and Atlanta was very bad against the run. And I figured, okay, well, you know, this is going to be a game where the Patriots are going to get LeGarrette Blount going and it's going to be a solid run attack. And it's a lot more Blount than we expected. And then he like played 12 snaps and was mediocre and didn't play the rest of the game. So even though the Falcons are 29th against the run so far in DVOA, I have to admit that, you know, it depends on the game context, of course. If the Patriots get ahead early, you know, could they run the ball effectively in the second half? Hardly out of the question. But I think it's a little tougher of a matchup than maybe the numbers seem to indicate. And the Falcons, they really need to start getting after the quarterback. Getting Vic Beasley back, as they did, I believe, a week ago, will help matters. But they're 28th in adjusted sack rate at Football Outsiders. So major trouble getting after the quarterback. And I have to admit, I'm a little concerned about Matt Bryan, who played last week but had a back injury that was keeping him out of practice. He has been kept out of practice so far this week. And he's a big part of that offense. And even if they don't score touchdowns, if they can get a consistent 3 points, that's a huge advantage for the Falcons, even given how good Stephen Gostkowski is. So I would be concerned if they have a kicker who's on 100%, whether it means that he's going to kick and just be not his usual self, or if they have to turn things over to another kicker.
Yeah, I'm looking at our special teams ratings right now. We got New England 14th and Atlanta 12th.
Mm-hmm.
And Atlanta is +5 in kicking for points, field goals next to points.
Yep.
New England's +1.9, so that's been a big edge for Atlanta.
But if Bryant's not healthy, that's a concern.
Over the course of the season, it has been plus for Atlanta. They're not playing over the course of the season. They're playing for 3 hours on a Sunday.
Right.
My biggest takeaway from this is, both offenses should be great all day. New England's the worst defense overall. I think 30th against the run, and they're dead last in stuff rate. So Atlanta has nothing to fear from running. They're not going to lose yardage very often at all. So they'll be able to get to third and makeable should be a pretty reasonable goal. And then if it does get to third down, their offense should be all over the Patriots defense. We've got the Falcons 9th on third down offense and the Patriots 22nd. So it's the edges are for the offense so much in this game. Just bet the over. Don't bet a winner, but realize that no lead is safe for either team.
Now, I have to ask you, Vince, you're someone who, of course, you live in the Seattle area. You've been in the Seattle area, I believe, your whole life. You grew up as a huge fan of Deion Sanders. I'm surprised you don't have more of an affinity for the Falcons and against the Patriots in this game.
I had a weird thing in the 90s. I was in high school in the early 90s, and the Seahawks, for those of you who don't know, were entering a string of the most boring decade of football there may have ever been. I want to say it was like 12 years in a row. It was 11 out of 12 or something, where they won 7-9 games. Mm-hmm. And the one exception, they went like 2-14 with the worst passing offense we've ever measured. So they were just a hideously dull team with nothing exciting about. And meanwhile, here's this team down south with really cool Jerry Glanville era black uniforms and this electrifying playmaker on defense and special teams and once in a while offense. And when he made a big play, it was a big play. It was an event. It was a celebration. And there was just so much more to cheer for there. And, I cheered for the Falcons for, actually more than a decade, really. And then it occurred to me it was the year Michael Vick went to prison. I was watching a Falcons game versus the Rams on Monday night, and they were getting killed. And it was like a light switch went off. I said, this team sucks. And I don't care if they win. Why am I watching them? And that was that.
Was that
another team in the NFL?
Was that Joey Harrington at quarterback for the Falcons?
Probably. I know he was the quarterback that year. They went through two or three guys, as I recall. But yes, Joey Harrington was their leading passer that year.
Who else was there? There was someone else who was like a veteran on that team who was there. Was it Joey Harrington and like Byron Leftwich? Does that make sense?
That actually sounds right. Let me look that up.
It was Joey Harrington, Chris Redman, and Byron Leftwich combining for 16
Chris Redman
stacks.
Was the other guy. Chris Redman, because I remember writing about that briefly for Football Outsiders, because it was the last day of the year. It was week 17 of 2007. They're on Monday Night Football. People may remember Roddy White scores a touchdown and pulls up the jersey with the free Mike Vick t-shirt underneath, which was a bad idea, by the way.
Yeah.
But as far as purely football goes, Chris Redman was the quarterback that day. He had been out of the league for 2 years. I think it was something insurance. And Atlanta's 2007 season was just one of the all-time great nightmare seasons. Bobby Petrino walks away, and Michael Vick's in jail, and they had to go sign this insurance salesman to come back and play quarterback for him. And he ended up playing okay. And I just made a note down the line, you know, if Chris Redman can be away from the league from 2 years and come back and play, I'm pretty sure Michael Vick will be able to, and he did. So there's your lesson in Falcons history.
That's what I was not prepared. I didn't know where that was heading. But yeah, Chris Redman, that final game, 17-27 for 251 yards and 4 touchdowns.
Yes.
I did not realize that Chris Redman was balling so hard in week 17 of that season. There are other things happening that
were perhaps overshadowing it.
Yeah, it's been a little bit. Not a lot, though. But yeah,
okay.
The point's there. It was like that was the peak of his career, unexpectedly. Another guy you mentioned who, in terms of playmaker wearing a black jersey, Adrian Peterson, who suddenly, out of nowhere, after being almost entirely useless in New Orleans, he suddenly revitalized the entire Cardinals offense last week. And I have to admit, I wrote about Adrian Peterson going to the Cardinals. I said, okay, well, I figure, you know, he's going to be better than he was in New Orleans. It could get things going. It's a good fit for him. I did not see that coming. So was there any reason to think that he would be that good?
Not that I can imagine. Arizona has now for so long been the place where running backs go to die. Because the running back retirement home for Emmitt Smith and Edgerrin James and Chris Johnson a few times, and it seemed like Adrian Peterson would just be next in line. And then, you know, boom, he kind of went crazy.
Yeah.
It did make me laugh a little bit when so much of the analysis afterwards was he never got a chance to get going in New England. He's a guy who needs lots of carries to hit his max,
mm-hmm.
to hit his potential. And to pick out the math here, he had 76 yards in the first quarter, 76 yards on 7 carries in the first quarter, 58 yards on 19 carries after that.
And that was with one. He had one really big play that was called back to.
Fair enough, but the idea that he is only productive when he gets a certain amount of carries is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah,
he was productive right out of the gate, and it's funny because I'm looking over the numbers of these matchups and I see Arizona. Again, this is the season, full season numbers, dead last in rushing DVOA, and that of course you can pretty much throw that out the window.
Yeah.
I don't know for sure how good they are right now, but I can promise you they are not the worst team in the league at running the football.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it just seemed like even beyond what Peterson was doing, it wasn't like, you know, he had a good game, but then everyone else was kind of still the same mediocre offense, and they were still kind of, you know, a shadow of the team they were a couple of years ago. It seemed to turn everything on for them. I mean, the Cardinals' offensive line before last week, they were 31st in yards before first contact on run plays. In the Peterson game, they were third. They were creating much bigger holes for Adrian Peterson, and then Carson Palmer, who, you know, looked pretty bad against the Eagles, has looked bad for most of this season, against the Bucs last week, 13 of 13 for 211 yards and two touchdowns in the first half. And, you know, that's not, you don't want to give Adrian Peterson the credit for all of that, but it did seem like the Buccaneers were approaching the Cardinals offense differently because they had Adrian Peterson running the football effectively.
Yeah, and those 13 completions, by the way, you'll see a lot of times when guys go 9 or 10 or 11 or 12, whatever, and say, oh, look at these great numbers. And you look closer, and a lot of those completions are like 2-yard gains on 3rd and 10. Palmer was not doing that.
No.
I think he had like 11 first downs, and the other two were like a 6-yard gain on 1st and 10 or a 9-yard gain at 2nd and 10.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, every pass was resulting in a good thing for Arizona for a while there. And he kind of cooled off, but you know, obviously he'd have to.
Yeah.
He's not going to maintain that pace for 4 quarters.
But still,
so
that's good.
The Cardinals, sorry?
That's good. You want that. Like, even if he cools off, that's still pretty solid.
Fair enough. That's a solid point. Since you bring this up, they've got the Patriots and Falcons at the main event game of the week, the headliner with all the star power.
Mm-hmm.
This Cardinals-Rams game in London is sneaky important.
Yeah.
It's going to decide, in one way or another, it's going to decide first place in the NFC West for right now. Mm-hmm. It may decide which of these teams gets a home playoff game and which team has to go on the road as a wild card game. If you know, the NFC is pretty jumbled right now, but you can easily see two or three teams in this division making the playoffs. There's just really a lot on the line here.
Yeah, according to the Football Power Index, there's a 21% swing for the Rams in terms of making or missing the playoffs based on winning or losing this game, which is one of the highest totals in the NFC, I think fourth in the NFC, heading into week 7. So obviously a really big game. The Cardinals still have a lot of work to do, but they do seem like a very different team with Adrian Peterson in the lineup. In terms of the flip side of this matchup, the Cardinals are fourth in run defense DVOA so far this season. So it does seem like, you know, given that the Rams seem to be a situation of whether it's either going to be Todd Gurley or Jared Goff, you know, kind of at the focal point of the offense, it does seem like a week where it's going to have to be Goff. And last week against the Jags, against a really good pass defense, he was, you know, pretty mediocre, 11 to 21 for 124 with a touchdown. He was 1 of 4 on throws to Sammy Watkins. So let me ask you this. Given that the Cardinals have one really great cornerback in Patrick Peterson and one dismal cornerback in Justin Bethel, and then Tyrann Mathieu, who has been pretty mediocre this year, do you stick Patrick Peterson on Sammy Watkins, or do you stick him on Robert Woods?
You know, it's funny. I watched the Seahawks-Rams game from 2 weeks ago, I guess, in Los Angeles, and it was Richard Sherman on Sammy Watkins for the entire first half. And, of course, the Seahawks, you know, primarily play zone, and Sherman stays on the left anyway. So it's kind of who lines up against him.
Mm-hmm.
But in the second half, he was following Robert Woods around the formation for quite a bit, lining up against their man coverage. And when they motion him across the field, and Sherman would go with him. So there is a strange, you know, this Rams offense, there's so many new pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're still figuring out what to do with each other, and opposing defenses are sure as hell still trying to figure out what to do with this team.
Right.
So it may be a case where you know, Robert Woods is emerging as the top guy ahead of Sammy Watkins, which would be a surprise. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things change. It's quite possible that we may see Patrick Peterson like glue on Robert Woods all day.
It does seem strange. And the only reason that I would say maybe not Patrick Peterson on Robert Woods, I think that's the logical thing. But the one thing I'd be concerned about is when Robert Woods beats you, it tends to be for like 12 yards. You know, it tends to be a pretty reasonable completion. But when Sammy Watkins beats you, it does seem more likely he's going to take it to the house. So that's the one thing I might be concerned about in terms of sort of, you know, placing one cornerback in one particular spot of the field. Just from your perspective, do you think it's better to be like the Cardinals and have one all-world cornerback and one just total, you know, disaster area cornerback? Or is it better to have two kind of decent cornerbacks and not have a guy who can really be a number one shutdown guy?
Well, we can go back to what we were talking about 50 minutes ago, those early 90s Atlanta teams,
mm-hmm.
where you had the, you know, you had the probably the league's best corner for mm-hmm. that the 5 years he was there, or sure. 5 or so years he was there. Those were not a lot of great Falcons defenses. And, you know, you can always say, okay, he's taking away that half of the field, we'll just go to the other guy. Mm-hmm. And Tim McKeir started to get beaten and burned so often on those Falcons teams, his own teammates were just calling him Highway 22. Because teams were just going for long drives against him all the time. So that's kind of where this Cardinals team is right now. Everyone is saying, well, just avoid Patrick Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
He grant him that half of the field. It's his. He can have it. We're just going to scorch Justin Bethel. And Tyrann Mathieu has not been great in coverage this year. Mm-hmm. And there's so many other ways we can beat you. We don't need to worry about using our number one guy.
Yeah. And the one thing
to answer your question, it's better to have a pair of really good guys than one star and one mediocre or worse guy.
I kind of agree with you. I do think that it's better not to have a hole than to have a total area of strength. I think if you look at, you know, some of the teams that have succeeded more recently, that tends to be the case. In terms of the Cardinals, I mean, they're a team on a defense. Their identity is really built around blitzing. They really want to rush the quarterback. They want to send extra guys. Jared Goff, the problem with that, he's second in the league in QBR versus the blitz this year. One sack on those blitzes on 42 tries from opposing defenses. So it does seem like teams have had trouble getting to him. And the offensive line's playing very well by all accounts. And it does seem like it's been a tough matchup for opposing defenses. So who do you think wins this game, actually? I think this is a really fascinating game to kind of handicap.
It is fascinating. The Rams are much better than they were in 2016, obviously. Mm-hmm. We actually have them projected as a playoff team in Football Outsiders Almanac this year, but honestly, for entirely the wrong reasons. We thought their defense would be exceptional,
mm-hmm.
and we thought the offense would improve just enough to get by, and they'd have a lot of 14 to 10 wins and things like that. Instead, the offense has been very, very good, and their defense, a lot of the times, hasn't been able to get out of its own way. We got them ninth overall until the DVOA, and I'll be honest, that's gone up in recent weeks. Playing the Jaguars, I think, will do that to you. It's funny, this year, this is a very strange year. We can all agree the Browns and Colts are very bad.
Sure.
We can all agree that the Chiefs have been better than anyone else, even though, as we all saw last week, they're not perfect.
Sure.
And basically, the other 29 teams are all tied for second. So it can change week to week. It can change quarter to quarter. We've seen so many comebacks and so many near comebacks that no lead seems safe, and you never know what's quite going to happen. It makes it all very, very unpredictable, which is why, getting back to answer your question, who do I think is going to win? Hell if I know. I don't even want to make a prediction.
That's fair.
I can tell you the Cardinals still have, despite as hot as they looked last week, honestly, I think a lot of that has to do with Tampa Bay, mm-hmm. who I don't think is anything, you know, the lower end of that 29-way tie for second place. I think Jared Goff is so much better than he was last year, but I'm still not sold on just how good he is.
Mm-hmm.
I think McVay's offense had an advantage over the league for a while because it was so new and teams were not used to seeing that offense from the Rams.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the cat's kind of out of the bag now, and teams are starting to catch up. And when you ask Jared Goff just beat the other team on pure ability, I don't think he's there yet. Mm-hmm. They probably should have beaten Seattle in that game. And as a team, they made a ton of mistakes, and many of them were on him. A couple of bad turnovers in the red zone in a game they ended up losing by 6 points. So there's still lots of holes in his game as well, as good as they've been this year. And in Arizona, how much trust can you put in a team whose best players are an old quarterback, a very old receiver, and a very old running back? This seems like a formula for doom. As good as they've been, it seems like they can't all be good all year forever, can they? So I have question marks about this team as well. The defense is very good against the run, and I think the biggest thing of that, honestly, is that just because they blitz so often, they have so many guys at the line of scrimmage, it's easier to fill all the gaps.
Yeah,
I know Chandler Jones is having a big year, but then all that blitzing leaves the secondary exposed. They're open to big plays, so like anything could happen here. Now you add in the fact that this game's in London. So you have all that travel, and as we've seen in London, strange things seem to happen in these games. So I have no prediction in this game. I wouldn't bet a dollar on anything happening. The Rams have been better most of the year. The Cardinals have more to lose. There's so many strange things going on that I have no idea what's going to happen.
Can I give you my prediction for Cardinals-Rams in London? Can I give you my prediction for the Cardinals-Rams game?
Yes, go ahead.
Since it is in London, I assume Blake Bortles will throw for 4 touchdowns.
Hey, you know what? Stranger things have happened.
That's true. That is true.
Like Blake Bortles throwing for 4 touchdowns anywhere.
Yeah, in his own uniform, let alone someone else's uniform.
Right.
It does. I agree. I have no... I cannot make heads or tails of this game. I could believe any possibility. There's just so many things up in the air with the Cardinals, given how different they looked with Adrian Peterson. I really feel like we need to see more in the way of reps from him before we get a real sort of grip on what this Cardinals offense can be with him in the lineup. We have to hit a break. We're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. Hey, guys. I've got some interesting facts for you here from the folks at Gillette. Did you know the tip of a Gillette razor blade is measured on an atomic scale? That means their blade edges are thinner than a single brain cell. And that precision is the work of many brain cells. The hundreds of members of Gillette's research and development team have spent over 4,700 years combined working to make your shave closer and more comfortable. And that's longer than the Egyptian pyramids have been around. And while over 1,000 craftsmen and women in Boston are busy making your blades, another team is putting your blades through more than 60 extremely strict and precise quality checks. If the blades fail just one of these tests, it does not leave the factory. In other words, the hardworking people at Gillette never stop working to make your blades better. And now, that includes the price tag, because you can get Gillette blades at their lowest prices in years. See for yourself at GilletteOnDemand.com. Gillette, the best a man can get. Pricing applies to select products and is at the sole discretion of the retailer. All right, welcome back to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN, joined here today by Vince Verhey of Football Outsiders. We're previewing Week 7 of the 2017 season. And let's talk about Saints and Packers, a game that looked a lot more appetizing, perhaps, this time last week. And now it is a game where it is the... And I read about this today, a Saints defense that is number one in pass defense over the last 3 weeks, which is incredibly strange to say, the last 3 games, I should say, versus Brett Hundley making his first NFL career start of what may likely be many for the rest of the year, given that Aaron Rodgers is hurt. So given what we saw last week, given how things have happened in the past, given their receiving core, how much faith do you have in the Packers to be obviously not the same team they were with Aaron Rodgers, with Brett Hundley under center, but at least a competent team with Brett Hundley at quarterback?
I have been of the opinion for several years now the Packers have been, I'll say, a mediocre football team that has been elevated by the best quarterback of this generation, at least the last 5 years. Aaron Rodgers has been that good, and I have always thought that if they did not have him, their coaching and overall talent level will be a lot more exposed. So that's, you know, doesn't sound good. I do have as much faith in Brett Hundley as you can have for a lower drafted guy who hasn't gotten a chance to play much this year. We had him, I think, number 4 in our top 25 prospects this year. I had a lot of ups and downs at UCLA, but hopefully a couple of years on the Packers sidelines with coaching, playing alongside Aaron Rodgers. Hopefully he's had a chance to mature some. He should, make some exciting plays. We saw him, even as bad as he was last week when he was thrown to the Wolves with no preparation, he still had that play where he scrambled and found a guy on third down for a touchdown. It was a, it was a big play. It was the minority that week. But you can see the kind of thing he's capable of if he can sustain that kind of thing. So I'm anxious to see how it turns out. Curious don't want to be too strong a word. I'm anxious in that I hope he does well just because the league needs more good young quarterbacks. I don't necessarily think he will.
Yeah.
And then, as you noted, the Saints defense last week was probably the first time since, like, the Super Bowl that the defense won a game for the Saints.
Right.
But, and even then, you say the defense won the game, they still nearly blew a 45-10 lead. So this league is so weird this year, man. Things that shouldn't happen happen all the time. So
it's
for this game, I mean, this game is in New Orleans, right?
It's in Green Bay.
It is in Green Bay. Yeah, well, that's a plus for the Packers. But, for so many years now, we've seen the Saints just be a very good offense that can't keep up with its own defense, allowing teams to score. And now the defense is playing more up and down, but the offense is not quite as consistently great. Mm-hmm. Green Bay's defense they've been mediocre this year, and their offense honestly hasn't been great either.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's expected to get a lot worse. So the more you look at this, the more they kind of lean New Orleans. But like I say, I have no confidence in anyone doing anything anymore.
It's total chaos in the NFL, I think, is what we're learning
really
from
is.
This podcast.
And there's a lot of the line here. The Saints are 3-2, a half game back at Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Packers are 4-2, tied for first place. Because the Giants and 49ers have been so bad, the rest of the NFC gets those free wins. Most teams in the NFC have winning records right now, or at least 500. So the playoff race is so thick, there's a lot on the line here. We're a third of the way into the season. There's still so much that is totally unknown.
Yeah, definitely. I think what's going to be interesting about the Packers is seeing, how much the offense changes from what we saw with Aaron Rodgers. Brett Hundley was someone who, did run a lot of zone read stuff in college. I would be intrigued to see if the Packers do run more RPOs, do actually use Hundley as a running quarterback. And I wonder how much they can do about that in a week. Their bye's coming up next week, and it wouldn't surprise me if they change the offense more, given that they have a week off. But it does seem like that would be something they could use. And I think one of the reasons they might want to pursue that is that all of their tackles are hurt. They are down, I believe their first five. The first five players they would line up at left tackle, David Bakhtiari, Brian Bulaga, Jason Spriggs, Kyle Murphy, now Lane Taylor, who was starting at guard. I believe he is out this week for the Packers at tackle. I mean, there's just – it's kind of staggering how many offensive linemen have gotten injured for the Packers. Of course, David Bakhtiari and Brian Bulaga did practice, and it would be great if they could play. But I am a little nervous about that actually happening. And so now you can't rely as heavily on the running game. You can't rely on the offensive infrastructure to support a quarterback who's still developing, which when they did this last time in 2013, they were down Bulaga, but the rest of their offensive line was healthy. So they were able to kind of rely on that. And that gave, not that Matt Flynn was great or Scott Tolzien was great. They were pretty bad, to be fair, but it gave them just enough support to do things. So I'm a little nervous about that. And then I don't believe the Saints defense is actually great. I don't believe they are the number one pass defense in football like they've been over the past 3 weeks. But they don't have to be that great. They just have to be okay. If they're I quoted this in my column. I think I mentioned it once before on the podcast maybe, but over Drew Brees' tenure in New Orleans, the Saints have had a defense that was 25th or better in DVOA four times. And those four times they won an average of more than 11 games and made the playoffs each time. So they don't have to be even 15th, which I think is where they are right now. If they can just not be in the bottom quarter of the league, if they can just be in the top 75%, that's kind of enough for Brees and the Saints to make it to the playoffs. That's kind of staggering that they haven't been able to more frequently, given how good Drew Brees is and how much they've tried to invest in improving the defense. But 3 weeks of very solid defense, and this could be It could be a really imposing team if it's Breeze and a pretty good defense as opposed to a horrific one.
We've been tracking the Saints defense for, you know, obviously, well, as long as we've been around at Football Outsiders. But 2 or 3 years ago, when they were they became the worst defense we ever measured. Mm-hmm. And they've been, you know, around the very bottom of the league every other year for the past 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
And to say they're a bad defense doesn't understate, or it understates how horrible they have been and what a burden this has been on Drew Brees. you know, they have a Hall of Fame caliber quarterback who's won, I think, 7 games 3 of the past 4 years. That's astonishing. That's impossible. And we started to think there had never been anything like this before. But then, over the summer, we've been going back over old play-by-play data and adding prior seasons. So we now, this summer, added 88, 87, and 86. And what we have found is that Miami Dolphins defense was worst in the league every single year. So Dan Marino equals Drew Brees. They're essentially had the exact same career, except Marino's Super Bowl was early in his career and he lost. Andrews was later in his career and he won. But otherwise, they have been the same thing, putting up video game numbers each and every year without fail, and it doesn't matter because their defense is so bad, no one can win. That's where Drew Brees has spent his entire career, and it is kind of sad. It's really very sad. In hindsight, I thought for the Saints, for their own sake, just because due to age, I figured, honestly, I didn't think Brees would be this good for this long.
Right.
I thought the Saints would have been better off trading him and rebuilding. And I thought it would have been the best thing for him, too, to get away from this team and get somewhere where he can, you know, have a better chance at contending for the playoffs. And instead, he has stuck around, and they've been stuck on a treadmill for so many years now, just, you know, first team to 40 wins every week. And here we are. He's still effective. The defense has played better as of late. They haven't been great all year, mind you. We still have them just 15th in defense. But like mm-hmm. you say, an average defense with Drew Brees should win 12-plus games.
Yeah, it's kind of staggering. It just needs to be that confident, and they haven't been able to do that for so long, so horribly wrong. Who do you have in this game?
The more, you know, I was undecided coming in, but mm-hmm. the more I look at this, you got to figure the Saints have the advantage here. Tommy in his first start, the Packers don't have much of a running game. I'm not thrilled. You know, the injuries on the offensive line. Their wide receivers, you know, kind of up and down, and that, mm-hmm. and the defense hasn't been great all year either. I the more I look at this, I just figure that this, for 1 week, this is the Saints' year.
So you are taking a stance here after not being able to on Cardinals Rams. You're taking a stance on the Saints winning.
I refuse to take a stance on Cardinals Rams, but I will take the Saints in this game.
Fair. I agree with that sentiment. I do think the Packers will be okay in the long run. I do think Hundley will improve, but I do think they're going to have to get to their bye and really take a hard look at what they can do on offense before they're able to move things around. Let's finish up. I believe we're going to discuss your local team, the Seattle Seahawks and the New York Giants.
We had an email conversation saying which games you want to pick about. Do you want to pick to talk about?
Yes.
And after those first two or three, it's a wide open swath of it's just little to get excited about this week. It's not the best week of games I've ever seen. We kind of sort of settled on Seattle, New York, and I was against it at first just because I don't know what there is to say about the Giants at this point other than they beat Denver, but they should probably still lose to Seattle because Seattle's defense is about as good as Denver's, mm-hmm. and Russell Wilson is much better than Trevor Siemian or Brock Osweiler.
That's
done.
True. That's, I mean, that's
seems
not...
That seems like the whole game talked about right there.
None of that is wrong. But I do want to explore some possibilities within those possibilities. I think there's some interesting questions to be had. You know, I went back and watched that Giants-Broncos game closely, and I do admit, they weren't as impressive as the final score indicated. They did show up, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for, you know, the effort they gave and not quitting on Ben McAdoo, which I think nobody would have faulted them for, given the circumstances. You know, they did give a solid effort, and they played better on defense than they have at pretty much any point this season. But, I mean, this was a game where they got a lot of the breaks on fumbles. A lot of the tip passes went their way. I mean, it really could have gone differently with a little bit more luck for the Broncos. I mean, the Broncos came up short on 4th-and-1 from inside the 1-yard line. They missed a couple of field goals. It was a very sloppy game from a Broncos team that clearly was not as good as we saw during the first few games of this season. But the one thing that did seem interesting to me about the Giants in that game was they were able to run the football, and they're running the football against arguably the best run defense in football heading into that week. So I do wonder, do you think they'll be able to have some success moving the football on the ground against the Seahawks?
Seattle's run defense has not been nearly as good as I would have expected coming into the year.
Mm-hmm.
They've always been a pretty good run defense. Obviously, they've been pretty good defense almost all of the time for the past, 5 years. And then you had Sheldon Richardson, and I thought they were just going to be dominant, and yeah, they really haven't. We have them right now. Where is the run defense? Pardon me, I'm a little lost. Seattle defense, all downs rushing, 27th. That's the Giants. I'm sorry. Seattle's defense is 26th. I stand corrected. But they've given up a lot of big plays, way more big plays than mm-hmm. they've seemed to ever have in the past. Carlos Hyde had a bunch of big runs for San Francisco. Those are the ones that stand out. And a lot of big runs for Todd Gurley. They were fortunate to force a fumble at the goal line to keep him out of the end zone. But, Seattle's run defense has been a problem all year. And that's definitely something to be worried about. The Giants' offense, you talked about Green Bay having their top five tackles out. The Giants last week against Denver, I think they had the top five wide receivers out, top four or five. I'm looking up right now to see the names of the guys they had. Roger Lewis.
Yes, Roger Lewis Jr.
Roger Lewis, Tavares King, Travis Rudolph, and Ed Egan. Those are the names of the wide receivers who played for the New York Giants in an actual regular season game, in prime time, mind you, against Denver last weekend. And I was trying to figure out how their offense would function at all, too. I figured they'd bring out their goal line personnel the entire game.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't quite do that, but they did throw the wide receivers only when absolutely necessary. Seven targets, I think, and six of them were on third down. The other was on second and 10.
Mm-hmm.
So they ignored the wide receivers as much as possible. They ran the ball a lot, and they focused on the tight end and Evan Ingram. But Seattle's defense this year has been eighth against tight ends, which is, honestly, it's been kind of a weak spot for them in the past. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't look like it's something they should be worried about this week. This week, if New York's going to win, and I can easily see this happening, actually, it's going to be based on, exploiting Seattle's terrible offensive line
mm-hmm.
and getting a lot of yardage on the ground.
Yeah. I wonder what you do with Richard Sherman in this game, given that it does seem like it's possible we will see Sterling Shepard return, who I think is back in practice. I'll double-check that, but I believe he is back in practice this week. But he's someone who operates almost entirely out of the slot. He's limited, so this he's probably going to play. But so he operates out of the slot. You have Evan Engram, who's been very promising as a pass-catching tight end this year. He's been very productive for as far as rookies go. You have a tight end and a slot receiver as their two biggest weapons. Richard Sherman is someone who you don't typically put him on a slot receiver or on a tight end, but at the same time, do you want Richard Sherman up against Roger Lewis or Ed Egan? I don't think you do. I think you want to have him against their best receiver. So I do wonder, in the same sense with Patrick Peterson, what do you do with Richard Sherman in this game?
Well, Seattle, especially early in games, they play what they do. They do what they do. They tend to play heavy dose of cover three, with Richard Sherman usually on the defensive left side and lining up against whoever comes there. If the guy goes in motion, Sherman will just pick up a tight end to that side. He usually stays at home. They have, since Chris Richard took over as defensive coordinator, there's more exceptions to that rule. When they played the Jets last year, Sherman followed Brandon Marshall all over the place, left, right, slot, wide, short, deep. Richard Sherman was all over Brandon Marshall. So there's been more exceptions, but I don't think Sterling Shepard is the guy that you change your game plan for. I think you trust your defense to operate how it's supposed to, and that means sometimes you give up short receptions to slot receivers and tight ends, but you figure that gives you a chance to hit them, and eventually those hits will turn into drops, and those drops turn into punts, and then you get a win.
Yeah,
that's the basic blueprint of the Seahawks defense. It has been for a long time, and not really. I don't see a lot of need to change what they do for this team.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to make much of a difference. I do think that the Seahawks have some issues at cornerback outside of Richard Sherman, but I don't think it's going to make much of a difference against these Giants receivers. You would figure in a typical game, the Giants front four would give the Seahawks a lot of trouble given that offensive line, especially now that the guy who was one of the best guards in football last year, according to Tom Cable, Luke Jokel, appears to be out indefinitely with a knee injury. Who could have saw that one coming? But it does seem like Olivier Vernon might not be able to go. Rustin Richburg, their starting center, he might be out as well as he was a week ago. So they're beat up on both sides of the of the line of scrimmage. And I do think that, you know, after the bye, it does seem like maybe the Seahawks could be a little better on offense than they've been over the past few weeks.
You like to think so. The line has been, you know, a terrible, well, for a couple of years now. They've been playing without the guy who entered camp as the number one left tackle, George Fant.
Mm-hmm.
He's out for the year. Now they're out their left guard and Luke Jokel. So pieces are being shuffled, and it's like trying to put a car together when you're missing half the parts and the parts you have are all broken. our former colleague, both of our former colleagues, Mike Tenier, pointed out that the de-evolution of Seattle's offensive line over the years has gone from some good players, no good players, not actually offensive linemen, and this year it's been playing even though they are in imminent need of surgery, which is all factually true.
It's kind of staggering.
It's kind of that's what I was saying. It is. How they did this, you know, we could talk for hours about this, but it's a deliberate attempt to build a Super Bowl contending team, putting zero resources or virtually zero resources into the offensive line. I think when they signed Luke Jokel for $8 million this year, I think their total cap hit the line double.
Yeah.
Or close to it. It's ridiculous. But the biggest thing for me for the Seahawks offense is I saw a stat this year, or this week, that they have been playing Jimmy Graham in the slot and out wide a lot more often.
Mm-hmm.
And he is not, he had a touchdown against the Rams, he split out wide. That was a huge play, obviously. And it's, you know, the marriage between the Seahawks and Jimmy Graham for 3 years has not gone, it's been weird. It's not gone like anyone planned. It hasn't been a disaster that a lot of people would have you believe for most of that time.
Mm-hmm.
He's on the verge, I don't have it in front of me, but at some point in the next couple of weeks, he's going to set the franchise record for receptions by a tight end. So in you know, two full seasons, basically. But they're playing him out wide a lot more. And when he was with the Saints, they called him a tight end, but he was really just a giant slot receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And they just let him loose and out-jump guys and out-run guys. He didn't have to run great routes. He didn't necessarily have to, have great technical skill. Just be bigger and stronger and faster with better hands than the guy across the line from you.
Yeah.
And Seattle's taken this giant slot receiver, and they spent 2.5 years now trying to shoehorn him into being a tight end. And it hasn't been great. Like I say, it hasn't been as bad as a lot of people would tell you. But it certainly hasn't been great. It certainly hasn't been worth the cost they gave him to get him and the money they're paying him. So if they have finally figured out how to use him, and they finally figured out that despite, you know, if he's 6'6 and 280, whatever he is, you know, he's not a very good blocker. You can split him out wide and throw him the ball and let him win one-on-one matchups with sheer, pure, physical, raw talent. That's how you use him. There was a play, I forget which game it was now, but Seattle ran a bubble screen,
mm-hmm.
and it was Doug Baldwin, who was tiny, and Jimmy Graham, who was huge.
Yes.
They were out there throwing blocks. And this tiny little angry Doug Baldwin just throws his body at a guy, seesaws him, turns him upside down, throws him on to the turf, and this monstrous Jimmy Graham kind of does a little shove. He gets this guy out of the way. And I thought, you know, there is no... That in one play summarizes the exact difference between these two players perfectly. But anyway, getting back to this Giants game, if Seattle has figured out how to use Doug Baldwin well, that's another weapon Russell Wilson has in the passing game when they already have a bunch of good receivers.
You mean Jimmy Graham?
Jimmy Graham.
Right.
That makes them a lot more dangerous than they already have been. And so far, they have been erratic, but they have certainly been dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say, and I don't know if this number is entirely accurate, because it's hard to gauge, but I did mention this on Twitter. ESPN Stats and Info has recorded the Seahawks as throwing one screen pass this year. One.
You don't do a lot of them.
That's the thing. Even if like it's a little bit off, you know, even if like they're missing a few, it's still like under 10. It's clearly not very many whatsoever.
No. And there may have been plays in there that were they may have been designed as screens, but since Seattle's offensive line, even when they're trying to block, let guys do it right away. When they're trying to fake a block, like on a screen pass, they may as well just be made of smoke and just let the defenders run right through them. In fact, I know for sure there was one play. It ended up being called back for a penalty. But they tried. It may not have technically been a screen. It may have been like a quick hitch,
right?
A smoke route. But they snapped the ball, and five linemen tried to cut blocks, and five linemen missed. So what the result was is the ball is snapped, and you see five large men just belly flop, and then a swarm of defenders go after Russell Wilson, and what happened. But no, they've never been a very good screen team. It's something that I thought C.J. Precise would have a bigger impact on, frankly, when they got him out of Notre Dame. And he's been a great receiver, but he's been a great, like, slot and wide receiver.
Right.
Or like, running routes out of the backfield. The screen game for Seattle is still pretty much non-existent.
Yeah, that's very upsetting. I feel like, given their offensive lines being terrible, very loud, Slack, I apologize. Given how bad their offensive line has been, you'd think, okay, well, if we're not going to be able to block anyone, let's at least make it part of the design and set some screens up, but it does seem like that has not been a part of their plan so far. I think the Seahawks are going to win. I think the Giants are still pretty bad. It sounds like you're on the same page.
No, I am. Like I say, nothing would surprise me. It's an East Coast trip for Seattle, although at least they avoid the dreaded 10 a.m. Pacific time start. Right. So that's a big benefit to them. But they've been the better team most of the year. They're the better team on paper. They have way more matchup advantages than the Giants do, and they're healthier. So everything's pointing to Seattle win here.
Yeah, I agree. Vince, that's it. We got to four games. Thank you so much. Where can people check out more of what you are working on?
You can always check out footballoutsiders.com every day. We've got our weekly DVOA ratings go up every Tuesday afternoon or evening, showing you the power rankings everyone loves so much. We've got new content, analysis, and articles every day. My own quick reads column, looking at the best and worst players every week. You'll find that up shortly after Monday Night Football, every Monday night or Tuesday morning, depending if you're on the East Coast. And, footballoutsiders.com.
Awesome. Vince, thank you so much. I'll be back on, I'm sure, later on in the year.
Thank you, sir.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of the Bill Barnwell Show. We're going to come back at you next week. More podcasts coming, more Nickel Package coming on Wednesdays, but more of me talking about football here on Interweb. Thanks so much for listening.